You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 8th of July 2019 and you're listening to me, Sam Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say today that I have my co-host with me, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how you doing? Have you had a nice couple of weeks off there?
Yeah, I've had a very interesting couple of weeks with, I suppose, primarily family-oriented outings of various sorts, and on the whole the weather's been good, and I'm sort of feeling very positive about this summer, I suppose.
Excellent. Well, that's the important thing, isn't it, is family, and of course race and nation is just your extended family. That's why it's important that we stand up for our race and our nation. And our first story today concerns a black MEP who is standing up for his race and his nation, but of course his race is not the white race and his nation is not any of the British nations. He's actually a Somalian. He was a Somalian refugee who was voted in as being the mayor of Sheffield and then voted in as being a member of the European Parliament. And it seems he's caused a bit of a scandal on the first day when he went there. Newly elected Green MEP Majid has blasted the European Parliament after he was asked to leave on his first day. The 30-year-old turned up to mark the opening day of the new legislature in Strasbourg, wearing a baseball cap and a t-shirt with the slogan F Fascism. He tweeted, "I know I'm visibly different. I don't have the privilege to hide my identity. I'm black and my name is Majid. I don't intend to try and fit in. Get used to it." Which, I mean, there is just so much we could get into in this. It's just the fact that he's walking into Parliament with a swear word on his T-shirt, F Fascism. He's got Hawaiian shorts on, a baseball cap that's turned around back to front. And he's upset that he was actually asked to leave. And he's obviously not there to promote Britain. He's not there to promote Sheffield. He's there to promote Negroes. And he's quite upfront about this, saying that I'm black and I don't intend to try and fit in. And we've all got to get used to it. And this is their attitude. We have to get used to them. They don't have to get used to us. They don't have to get used to our culture or our way of life. They don't even have to learn English. It's us that have to change our way of life to accommodate them. And this is the whole attitude of the non-whites and the blacks and the establishment. And it's completely insane. And I think this really shows this, because he doesn't think that he's doing anything wrong. Would anybody white think it was okay to turn up at the European Parliament in a T-shirt with swearing on it and shorts and a baseball cap on back to front? I think white people have got far too much respect for things like that. Even if we don't like the EU, I think white people would still have the respect for tradition to not show up there like that. I think this is absolutely disgraceful that he thinks this is okay and he thinks it's funny.
Yeah, I think this shows a general disrespect, really. I know that we are anti the European Union from the point of view of Britain's membership of the European Union, and I think that the European Union needs to be reformed, etc. And so in that respect, I don't have a great deal of respect for the ultimate aims of the European Union. But to turn up dressed the way that he did, assuming that the report that we've just read out is correct, to turn up like that is an act of disrespect to the people he's going to be working with personally. I've seen this in other situations, not necessarily in a black and white kind of confrontational situation, but I've seen it where people sometimes decide that they are going to turn up to a business meeting where they know everybody else is going to be dressed in a suit and tie, but they'll just turn up without a jacket on and without a tie and just like an open neck shirt. And it's kind of in two different ways. In one way, it's saying, I think I'm better than you and I don't have to try to impress you. I'm so good. But on the other hand, it's saying, I don't really respect you, but I'm glad that you respect me by virtue of the fact that you're wearing a suit and tie when you come to see me or when I've come to meet you. I also see this sometimes as well where you get people who are kind of like in the underclass of our society, people who have covered themselves in all sorts of bizarre tattoos so that they look, you know, a bit like a freak, or where they perhaps have their hair in a particularly freakish way, and perhaps who dress in an outlandish kind of way, and then they complain that they can't get a job. And it's all because, you know, if you turn up for a job interview dressed like a clown, you can't actually expect to get the job. And this guy, it would appear from the from this report, turned up to the European Parliament pretty much dressed like not quite like a clown, but like somebody who was having a slow day when they were on holiday or something somewhere hot, and who, you know, by virtue of the slogan on his T-shirt, really wanted to be confrontational, really wanted to be controversial right from the very beginning. And it would appear if he was asked to leave, that he got precisely what he was asking for. And because I don't think anybody who seriously expected to go to Strasbourg and be involved in the kind of governmental meetings and things that they have there, you know, would have gone dressed like that if they, you know, if they were at all serious about it. And that's, I suppose, really all I've got to say on that.
Yeah, he was wearing African national dress, as you said to me before we began this podcast. I think that's what he was doing there.
Well, West Indian national dress, perhaps.
Yeah,
but the sort of clothing somebody would wear if they were on holiday in the Caribbean and they were just, you know, larking about on the beach or something. But you wouldn't turn up to a governmental or business meeting dressed like that.
Well, of course, he's had photographs before when he was actually sworn in as mayor. He had all these pictures of him squatting on the mayor's table, dressed up like that, with wearing the mayor's chain like it was some kind of Negro bling. And there was other pictures of him sort of squatting on top of the stair rail on the stairs, just monkeying about, basically like a monkey. I mean, he's the monkey mayor. He deliberately tries to make himself look like a monkey, probably hopefully so that people point out and say, well, you look like a monkey, and then they'll get accused of being racist, of course. After he was inundated with responses from people on Twitter, he added, thanks for the love and support, guys. Just to clarify, I obviously didn't leave, but to even be put in this position says a lot about what people think the stereotypical politician is meant to look like. While some people were seen to be supporting him, with many saying they were proud of him, others said he had not been dressed for work and that may have been the reason he was asked to leave. So again, what you've got here is he's refusing to obey the authority there. He's refusing to leave. He thinks that what he's doing there is breaking down stereotypes. I guess he ties that in with racism, I guess, because racism, you know, we're supposed to have these stereotypes, which is a wrong thing to have, even though actually having stereotypes protects people. It's a way of learning about people. You learn to discriminate between what is dangerous and what is not, and stereotypes play into that. So he thinks he's breaking down stereotypes by doing this, by crapping all over tradition, basically. And I think it's quite shocking, really, that lots of people supported him and said that they were proud of him for doing this. I mean, how could anybody in Sheffield be proud of their mayor turning up like that? And who does he think the fascists are that he's saying F the fascists? Because he's spoken out before calling Donald Trump a fascist. I think, and decided he was going to ban Donald Trump from Sheffield, even though he's got no powers to actually ban Donald Trump from Sheffield. Speaking after the incident, he added that he had been unsure of who the official was and said, "I make people feel uncomfortable. People don't know how to react." Is that what politicians are supposed to do? Make people feel uncomfortable? The former Lord Mayor of Sheffield continued, "MEPs don't reflect the people that they represent, Europe-wide, and I know I'm going to stick out like a sore thumb." Speaking to the Mail Online, a spokesperson for the European Parliament said they had immediately investigated the matter, and they say that no member of Parliament's staff was involved. And they also added that they had informed Mr. Majid of this. Now, they did a proper investigation, and they discovered that, actually, no, nobody had asked him to leave. And I got a suspicion that that's actually correct. Nobody asked him to leave, and he just made all this up to draw attention to himself. Because, you know, I mean, you can't really imagine that the member of the Parliament staff there, they would not have wanted to be accused of being racist, sending out this black guy because he wasn't dressed properly. Because obviously the black guy could then say, "Well, you're just being racist. This is my normal Negro clothes that I wear." So I don't think this actually happened, Max. I think he just made this up to draw attention to himself.
Well, I don't know whether he just made it up or whether it actually did happen. What I would say is that you wouldn't turn up to a parliamentary gathering, a parliamentary meeting. You wouldn't turn up to any business meetings dressed like that unless you were trying to attract attention, unless you were trying to cause a certain amount of commotion. And as I say, it would appear that he got exactly what he wanted. If indeed, you know, the contents of this report are true, It shows a lack of respect for the people he was going to be working with. And there's not a lot more else to say, really, I don't think. It's regrettable that people get elected whose intention is, who feel that they have to make a point in the way that he tried to make a point here, because the fact of the matter is that when people go to visit their MP, they don't expect to go and see somebody who is just like somebody that lives next door. They don't go to see their MP because they want to see somebody who is ordinary. They go to see their MP because they want to see somebody who has got some influence in society and who can help them to overcome the problems that they've got. So people go and see their MP with the expectation that their MP is going to be somebody who's capable and influential and who is able to get on with other people, who's good at networking with other people and can therefore advance any kind of problem that they've got and help them to resolve any kind of problem they've got. You don't go and see your MP with the expectation of seeing somebody, you know, sat in a T-shirt with a rude slogan across the front. And that's the long and the short of it, really. You know, it would appear that he wanted to make a statement, and that statement is that he doesn't really have any respect for the people he was going to be working with. And that's it, really.
All the voters, you've got no respect for the voters either. I mean, I think this is just symptomatic of the way everything is nowadays. We're supposed to make films and movies that apparently reflect the people that go and watch them. So we're supposed to have lots of blacks in the movies now, and we're supposed to have lots of homosexuals, and we're told we've got to have lots of women in Parliament and lots of homosexuals in Parliament because they have to be exactly the same as the people that they're representing. You take that to its logical end, and you start saying, well, people with Down syndrome have got to have Down syndrome people representing them. Children have got to be taught by children rather than taught by adults, because they've got to be taught by somebody who is the same as them. I mean, where does it end? And this is why he thinks he's being clever by going in there dressed up as a ghetto Negro, because he's saying, well, I represent the ghetto Negroes. But I'm sure a ghetto Negro would rather have somebody with the intellect of a lawyer and respect for tradition actually representing their interests rather than somebody that goes in there and commands no respect whatsoever and just looks like a clown. I mean, that just seems to be what he's doing. And the fact that people tweeted him and said that they were proud of him for doing this, and the mainstream media have bigged it up and said, oh, this was all a big laugh. And I think that, you know, he wanted to draw attention to himself and it didn't get enough attention. So then he tweeted out, well, I've just been kicked out. I've just been kicked out of the building. And I think that was either an exaggeration or it was just made up entirely, because the investigation has shown that nobody actually kicked him out. And just while we had this story, which is about this. Go on, Max. You want to say something else?
I was just going to say, I wonder whether he's gone back since and whether having gone back since, he's actually gone back dressed more appropriately for...
Well, he never left. He never left, did he? I mean, he admitted that. He never actually left. So apparently he was asked for leave, but he didn't leave. I mean, that was part of his tweet as well. So he just stayed there. So it's a bit of a non-story just to draw attention to him and to try and make out that... you know, that the EU are racist or clothesist against him, I guess, discriminating against him because of his clothes. And in this next story that we've got here, I mean, I think it's quite a contrast here. We've got a patient that is being lambasted and attacked in the mainstream media simply for asking to be able to see a white doctor, which I think is something that more people should actually do this, because it highlights the fact that we don't actually have freedom of association. You know, if you can't choose to see a doctor of your own race, then you don't have freedom of association. And this is a story here. A hospital boss has blasted a patient who walked into A&E and demanded he be treated by a white doctor. They say the appalling incident happened at Wigan Infirmary in June. Well, why should it be appalling to want to be treated by somebody from your own race? I mean, there are two reasons for this. One reason that foreign doctors are far more likely to be struck off for absolute terrible mistakes that they've made, gross incompetence. And the other reason is that if you're treated by somebody who is the same as you, they're far more likely to understand what you're saying to them and to sympathize with you. It's like if you're a male, you would far rather be treated by a male doctor because the doctor has the same parts that you have, for a start. A female doctor wouldn't. And these Muslim women, they demand to be seen by a female doctor. And I think most of the time they ask to be seen by a Muslim doctor as well. And we don't actually get any news stories about that. But this is seen as an absolutely appalling incident that somebody asked to be treated by a white doctor. And he didn't demand to be treated by a white doctor either. As we see, he was quite polite about this. And then it says that the patient then followed up their racist behavior by making a formal complaint. The patient, who is not being identified, has written to the trust complaining that they were unable to see a white doctor and demanding an apology. And I think that's really good of him to have done that, to say, well, look, this is not on. I wanted to see a white doctor for whatever reason. And the patient should always be right, really. I mean, if the patient doesn't want to be seen by a coloured doctor, I think he should be able to be seen by a white doctor. That's what freedom of association is all about. It means you have the freedom to associate with who you want to associate with. Do you not think that's how it, you know, how it should be, Max? I don't know how this stands in law, really. I don't think this is discrimination.
Well, I'm sure the people who are trying to foist a multicultural society on us would regard it as discrimination. What I would say is that I would agree with you that freedom of association means that you should be able to choose the people that you interact with in society. You shouldn't have to interact with everybody that is a member of the society within which you live. And if you go to see a doctor, then you are probably going to be better served by a doctor that has an affinity with you. There's a saying in business that people like them. And one of the ways of making somebody like you, one of the ways of getting business from somebody in a business context is to appear to them to be as much like them as is possible. Obviously, you don't want to sort of pretend to be somebody and completely ape them in every possible respect. But if you develop the conversation on lines which show that you've got things in common, then that makes people feel that you are somebody like them, which makes them more predisposed to like you, and therefore more likely to do business with you, which is, you know, in a business context, what you're hoping to do. And so from the point of view of going to see a doctor, you would obviously want the doctor to be somebody who has an affinity with you, so that they understand your complaints, so they understand the way that you feel. And I don't see there's anything wrong with a woman going into a hospital and asking to be seen by a woman doctor. I don't see there's anything wrong with a man going into a hospital and asking to be dealt with by a man doctor. And I don't see there's anything wrong with somebody asking to see a doctor that is of the same race or nationality as themselves. In fact, I don't see there's anything wrong with going into a hospital and asking to be dealt with by a doctor who is of the same religion as you, if you've got a religion where there are particular issues that that impinge upon your health and the kind of medical treatment that you're likely to want to have. You know, this is an issue of freedom of action, freedom of association, and if we're supposed to live in a free society, why shouldn't we be able to do those things? I don't see there's anything wrong with it. Now, obviously, if you're involved in an accident and you're taken into a hospital and the hospital doesn't have any white doctors available and you're white and you would prefer to be dealt with by a white doctor, then you've got a choice. You can either go away and find a hospital where there is a white doctor and be treated by that white doctor, or you accept the doctors that are there and take whatever treatment they're able to give you. So it's really a matter of supply and demand. You know, if the supply is there, then why shouldn't you be able to make the choice that you want to make? Why should you have to just take pot luck and in a situation where you could have been seen by a doctor of the same race as yourself, against your wishes, you are forced to be dealt with by a doctor of a different race. You know, it's not right that should happen. It's only right, really, that people should have the freedom to choose what they want to do and the freedom to associate with those people that they want to associate with.
We've also got the instance at the moment, we've got black students demanding to be taught by black teachers, because how can they be taught by a white teacher? A white teacher can't understand what it's like to be black. We're being told we need to have more black judges, because otherwise more blacks get sent to prison, and they think that somehow having more black judges is going to prevent more blacks going to prison. So it's okay for blacks to demand to be seen by blacks and to be taught by blacks, but it's not okay when whites politely ask for the same. And this white guy, obviously it wasn't a critical emergency, because he did walk out and then he put in this complaint. He obviously knows that there are white doctors there. Andrew Foster, the chief executive officer of Writingham, Wigan and Lee NHS Foundation Trust, tweeted earlier today, "Would you believe a patient coming to A&E and asking to see a white doctor? When politely told that a white doctor is not available, the patient walked out and has formally complained about this. This was hugely upsetting for the staff involved. Appalling." Mr. Foster, who has been the CEO of the Trust for 12 years, told the Manchester Evening News, "He is angry on behalf of my staff and has banned the patient from Wigan Infirmary. They will still receive emergency treatment at A&E if needed, but for anything else, they will have to go elsewhere. And Mr. Foster has also raised the incident with Greater Manchester Police." Why would that be upsetting? You know, if it's not supposed to be upsetting for white teachers in universities when the blacks, the students there, say, well, we want to be taught by black teachers, and the blacks are appeased in this, why is it upsetting when it's the other way around and a white man says, well, I'd like to be treated by a white doctor? Why should that be hugely upsetting for the staff involved? I would have thought that the staff involved would understand that. The only reason why it's upsetting for them is because they've been told that they should be upset at this, and that this is somehow racism.
Well, there are two contradictory arguments here. One is the one that you've just been expounding. The other one relates to something that you touched on a little bit earlier on, which is where you have a situation where a politician, I remember David Cameron, when he first became prime minister, was saying that there weren't enough members of parliament who were women, and there weren't enough members of parliament who are from ethnic minorities. And there is this assumption that the general makeup of parliament has to reflect the general makeup of the population at large, or else parliament can't properly represent the nation as a whole. And there is this assumption that the police force, particularly the police force in London, this seems to get spoken about, has to, in terms of its ethnic and racial composition, has to mirror the ethnic and racial composition of the population of London, or else it can't properly police London. And the people that make these statements are the sort of people who would say that all human beings are created equal. Well, if all human beings are created equal, and a white doctor or a white policeman or a white member of parliament is no better, is not superior to a black doctor or a black policeman or a black member of parliament, and if both of them are equal, then changing parliament from being entirely white to being part white and part non-white, or changing the police force from being wholly white to being part white and part non-white, wouldn't make any difference, because if the people are equal and the way in which they would police would be the same, it wouldn't make any difference. The parliament, which was entirely white, would govern in exactly the same way as the parliament that is partly white and partly non-white. The parliament that is wholly male would govern in exactly the same way as a parliament which is partly male and partly female. Now, the reason why these politicians that are trying to promote multiculturalism, multiracialism, the reason why they insist on increasing the proportions of people from minority groups within parliament, within the police force, and within the National Health Service, is because they know that the service that's provided by these people is qualitatively different. And it's qualitatively different in a way that is pleasing to those people who belong to the minority groups and who are going to be served by these people. And so if it is qualitatively different to such an extent that people from a minority group should insist that the service that they have should be composed of people that include people like them, then it should also be perfectly right for somebody who is white, who is from the ethnic majority, to choose to be served by somebody who is of the same ethnicity or the same race. And so if one argument is right, the other has to be right as well. Whereas if one argument is wrong, then the other has to be wrong as well. And so, as I say, these are two contradictory things that are being put to us. One, that we as white people aren't allowed to choose and aren't allowed to believe that there is any qualitative difference between a service provided by somebody of our race and the service provided by somebody of a different race, whereas people from the ethnic minorities are supported in their belief that the service that they will get is qualitatively different.
Yeah, it's inconsistency. It's neurotic, basically. I mean, this chap, I mean, he wasn't even I don't know whether they just haven't reported it or whether he wasn't given a chance to, but he hasn't even said his reason for why he would want to be treated by a white doctor. And there are very good logical reasons for that. 75% of all doctors struck off for gross incompetence are non-white. five times more likely to be involved in a catastrophe than white doctors as well. Five times more likely a non-white doctor is likely to be involved in a catastrophe. Now, the Mail did a Freedom of Information request that revealed among doctors already working in Britain, 273 of the 374 struck off for misconduct or incompetence in the past 5 years were foreign trained, while 66 of the 85 removed from the medical register in 2014 received their medical degree overseas. So there are good logical reasons, facts and statistics to back up as to why you would wish to be treated by a white doctor. I doubt very much that the reason why this patient wanted to be treated by a white doctor was simply because he didn't like the colour of the skin of these foreign doctors, which is an absolute nonsense. Well, describing what happened, Mr. Foster said the patient came into the hospital's A&E department in mid-June and was triaged as usual. A young doctor went into a cubicle to see the individual to start the diagnostic process, Mr. Foster said. The young doctor was told right at the outset, "I do not want to see you. I want to see a white doctor." I mean, perfectly reasonable request, perfectly polite. The young doctor was very junior and didn't really know how to respond. The doctor left the cubicle and contacted a consultant who also happened to be non-white. The consultant went to speak to the patient, who repeated a preference for seeing a white doctor. The consultant calmly explained that that isn't the way that it works. You have to see the next available doctor. The patient then said, "Well, I'm off," and left. There was no violence or shouting. It was a simple request, and that would have been the end of it. And then I received this formal complaint asking for an apology. So, you know, what is wrong with this? Why is this headline news that somebody has asked to see the best doctor possible? I mean, that's what it is. Basically, if 75% of all the people struck off are foreign doctors, then it's in your own best interests to say, "Can I be seen by a white doctor?" I mean, it's probably in the best interests of non-whites to request to be seen by a white doctor. I'm sure out in India, if they've got a choice of seeing a white doctor or seeing an Indian doctor, they would probably say, "Well, I'd rather see the white doctor," because you know that they're going to have been given a much better medical education than these non-white doctors. I mean, the facts speak for themselves. This is the reason. It's not discrimination. It's not not liking the colour of the skin. It's just knowing the facts and statistics that surround the employment of these foreign doctors in the NHS, which we're told would fall apart if it wasn't for all these foreigners that we've got in it. And yet they are responsible for 75% of all the people that have been struck off. And they're only struck off if they've done absolutely terrible damage to patients, because the NHS will do all that it can to cover up for doctors that have had allegations made against them. There's been big scandals about that as well, about how they cover up for them. And yet, even with all that covering up, they're still responsible for 75% of all the gross incompetence. You know, to actually ask to be seen by a white doctor is quite a reasonable request. Mr. Foster said the junior doctor who was first complained to had not experienced such overt racism before and has been left very, very upset. He added, "She is doing a fantastic job for patients. She speaks English as well as I do. There is no reason for this whatsoever. I felt it appropriate to share with the public, and we're grateful that 100% of the responses are supportive. I've been the CEO for 12 years, and it's not the first time I've heard of incidents of racism and homophobia. What is unique is writing to us to complain, and that is what has really taken the biscuit." Well, why was somebody left very, very upset at this? I mean, he may think that this doctor speaks English as well as he does, but the patient may have had a difficulty in understanding what they're saying, which is a very, very common complaint with these foreign employees, that, and especially with these foreign doctors. I know people that elderly people that have been into the hospital, and they've got no idea what the doctor has been saying to them because they haven't been able to understand them.
Yeah, I think the issue here isn't necessarily one of assuming that the non-white doctor is an inferior person. It's a matter that there is the probability that a non-white doctor will be from a foreign country and that English may not be their first language. And so although they may be able to speak English, they wouldn't necessarily be familiar with all of the nuances within the English language that could be a factor in the conversation that the patient wants to have with the doctor. It also is a matter that as far as the training that doctors and medical staff receive, we know what the standard is. We're used to the standard of medical training that exists here in UK training hospitals. We don't know what the standard of training is in third world training hospitals. And so if a doctor is from a third world country or potentially from a third world country, then we don't really know whether the training that they've received is as good as the training that they would have received were they a British doctor. And so they are perfectly good reasons for somebody to want to exercise their right of choice. And again, it is purely a matter of freedom of choice, and I don't see why people should be denied freedom of choice. And if, you know, if somebody chose they didn't want to deal with me for any reason, just purely because they didn't like the way that I looked or they thought I was different from them, then I would just say, fine. You know, I've got no need to force people to deal with me. I don't see why a doctor should feel rejected and hurt by virtue of the fact that somebody says to them that they prefer to see a doctor of their own nationality or their own ethnicity. It's not an insult. It's just a request that somebody ought to be able to be made. And if you go to hairdressers or, you know, barbers to get your haircut, you know, people routinely choose the same stylist because they know that stylist remembers them and does the style that they like just the way they like it. The stylists don't get all hurt and rejected if somebody says, "Oh no, I don't want to have my hair styled and cut by you. I'd like to wait until so and so is free so that I can have my hair done by them." Or if somebody telephones into hairdressers and says that they would like a particular stylist to do their hair and they're prepared to wait until that stylist is available, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that whatsoever. Why should it be any different with regard to medical treatment? It's just solely that those who are trying to force multiculturalism down our throats feel that it's important that they that they're able to enforce things like that and to deny us the our freedom of choice. And it's a very sad indictment, really, of the National Health Service that they don't offer people freedom of choice.
Well, we'll have to wait and see how this formal complaint turns out. You brought up there the actual medical training that they receive. And in these third world countries, loads of bribery goes on. You know, it's not out of the realms of possibility for people just to pay a certain amount of money and they get given a ticket saying that they've passed the course. I mean, we've had people claiming to be licensed doctors, and it's been found out that they're not actually capable of doing the jobs that they've been hired for at all, and that's because they've bribed their way to actually get the qualification at the end of it. We also know that in I think it was in Johannesburg University where they did IQ tests, and the average IQ was found to be 85, whereas the average IQ of a British doctor is probably going to be somewhere around 120. I mean, what this is it's a risk aversion strategy. And that's all that most so-called racism is a risk aversion strategy. You see the facts, you see the statistics. Sensibly, you wish to avoid risk. So you wish to avoid situations where there is going to be a high risk of something bad happening, and being treated by a non-white doctor is one of those situations. The same as being around these people if they're of a criminal type. I mean, it's, you know, you're still at risk no matter who they are, whether they're a doctor that could be done for gross incompetence, or whether you're in the wrong part of town and you've got black and non-white criminals around you. And this next news story that I've got here concerns these non-white criminals. An Afghan asylum seeker stalked random people in Croydon, South London, asking them if they were English and then stabbing them if they said yes, prosecutors have claimed. Jurors at the Old Bailey were shown CCTV footage, which prosecutors said showed Sami Lahak Akbari, 32, approaching shoppers at a Tesco Extra in Thornton Heath, armed with a large knife, asking them if they were English, and trying to stab them if they answered in the affirmative. On that evening in January this year, this defendant had set out deliberately to threaten, harm and kill members of the public by virtue of their nationality, or what Mr. Akbari perceived to be their nationality. They were all English, alleged prosecutor Heidi Stonecliffe. Akbari is said to have gone on to pull a knife on people at the nearby Kebabish restaurant and at the Plough on the Pond pub on Croydon's London Road, fuelled with the same intention as in the Tesco Extra, and asking people aggressively and repeatedly where they were from. Akbari denies charges of attempted murder and wounding with intent. The trial continues. So where are the hate crime charges there for discriminating against somebody on because of their race, basically? Where is the aggravated hate crime charges that should have been added to this, because this is specifically going after somebody because of their race, and there's no mention of that at all because the victims were English, because the victims were white. If the victim is white, then the person attacking you can't possibly be a hate crime, the same as it can't possibly be racism if it's done to whites by somebody who is black. I mean, it couldn't get more obvious than that these hate crime charges are specifically can only be used against white people. And yet here we've got an instance of exactly what we're told, you know, white people do. They go out and they attack these non-whites simply because they're non-white. That's what we've got here. A non-white going out attacking people because they're English. And that there's no mention of that in the charges. There's just a mention of it in the court, but no charges that are actually related to this. I just think about this.
Yes, you can imagine what would be the situation had the assailant in this been a white person who was going around asking people if they were English and stabbing them if they said no, they weren't, or just stabbing only people who were non-white, for example. Then, you know, this would be regarded as being a heinous example of a race crime, and it would be correct that it would be, and this would be the main thread of this story. And yet, as you quite rightly point out, in this particular case, in this article that you've looked at here, the racial motivation is not mentioned whatsoever, and it's very strange that that's the case. And I think that we see this quite a lot with attacks that are made upon people, where it appears that the person doing the attacking is motivated by racism, but because they are non-white, the racism doesn't get mentioned or it gets downplayed. Whereas if it was the other way around and the assailant in the case was white, then it would be the main thing, and the person would be denounced as a racist, and everybody would think, you know, how terrible it was.
You know, we've got foreign people in our country that want to kill us, and that's exactly what is happening here. What is happening here? It couldn't get any more obvious than that, and yet nothing is done about it. None of these people are deported. These crimes just increase. I mean, we've got so many stabbings that are going on in London now. I mean, just over the weekend, there was a white woman stabbed, and I think, and her three children. And the assailant was a black guy. I don't know if he actually murdered them all or if he just murdered the white mother. And the kids were harmed. But it did say that the victim was European, and it was a black guy that did it. And we see these videos on Twitter and on YouTube with these blacks talking about how much they hate white people, and then they carry out these violent attacks, and nothing is done about it. Nothing is done about it at all. It's just we're the only ones that talk about it.
And this is a failure of vetting on the part of the immigration services. You know, our immigration system is one which effectively doesn't vet people. And unless somebody has presumably got some kind of a warrant out for their arrest, if they manage to illegally gain access to this country, then nothing is actually done about it. Or if somebody, you know, immigrates into this country legally, unless there happens to be an arrest warrant out for them, then nobody ever thinks that they should perhaps be questioned. And the assumption always is that somebody who comes to this country because they love the British way of life and they want to. They want to enjoy the British way of life. But as we've seen with lots of cases, people come to this country for all sorts of reasons. Some of them come to this country with malicious and murderous intent, as the various Islamic bombers and things have shown in times gone by. And there ought to be some kind of a system whereby anybody wishing to come and live in the British Isles ought to be questioned about their motives. And, that would be a perfectly sensible thing, ought to be questioned about, why they want to come to our country. And some assessment should be made as to whether the immigration authorities feel that the person is a fit and proper person to be given British nationality. That's the most obvious thing. And yet, because of a fear of being perceived as being racist, people don't do something which is, quite obvious. If somebody knocked on your door and asked if they could come and live in your house, if you didn't know anything about them, the very least you would do is actually ask them who they are and what their background is, and you'd want to know something about them before you let them in. But apparently, as far as our country is concerned, we're quite happy to let people come in just because they want to come in, irrespective of what their motives are, and irrespective of whether they can demonstrate that they've actually got good intentions.
Oh, they just throw their passports away, don't they? I mean, this guy was an asylum seeker, an Afghan asylum seeker. So he had knocked on the door and asked for sanctuary, basically. And once he was let into the country, he then turned around and stabbed the people that had let him into the country, specifically looking for the people that had offered the hand of friendship to him, fed him, clothed him, put a roof over his head, and then turned around specifically looking for them so that he could then stab and kill them. And again, it's reported as the Afghan asylum seeker stalked random people in Croydon. He didn't stalk random people in Croydon. He stalked white people in Croydon, specifically white English people, that he could kill them. I mean, even this report from Breitbart doesn't actually say exactly what it is. It uses that random term that we see all so often when it's blacks attacking whites. It's a random attack, as if it's just an individual attack that's just happened on its own, never been heard of before, doesn't actually fit a very, very common pattern that we see. I mean, just about every day you hear about these black and white attacks, as I just said about this young mother that was stabbed to death in London. Well, we've got one other news story that we wanted to cover here. It's a bit of a geopolitical news story, but it concerns Britain, and that's this Iranian oil tanker that's been hijacked by Britain. And I'll hand over to you to describe what's happened here, Max.
Well, this fits in very nicely with this last story, you see, because what's happened is that earlier on this week, soldiers from the Royal Marines, I think it was, 30 of them, who were based in Gibraltar, were instructed to intercept an Iranian oil tanker that was passing through the Straits of Gibraltar on its way, allegedly, to Syria to take oil to Syria. Now, the soldiers were instructed to intervene and to stop the tanker and prevent it from going to Syria. Now, the Iranians view this as a hijacking, which in effect it is. But the hijacking has been defended by the British government and the authorities in Gibraltar on the basis that they were preventing a breach of the United Nations sanctions against Syria. And this is just another of the sort of aggressions that have been taking place, tit for tat kind of aggressions that have been taking place, aimed at inflaming the situation, in my view, with Iran. The Iranians are viewed as being the enemies that are threatening the free world. The Syrian regime is regarded by our authorities as being an enemy regime, and so we've seen fairly recently we've seen President Trump imposing or reimposing sanctions against the Iranians so that their economy is damaged, preventing them from or inhibiting their ability to sell their produce abroad, inhibiting their ability to sell their oil. We've had some sort of repercussions from that, in that it would appear that the Iranians disabled a couple of oil tankers passing through the Straits of Hormuz by putting mines on them. This is what's been alleged, that we've had a situation where a drone has been shot down, where the Iranians believe that the drone had flown into their airspace, but the Americans have denied that it was flown into their airspace. And all this situation is developing as a result of the opposition to the perfectly legitimate, perfectly legal regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and the determination on the part of the Americans and therefore our government to do everything they can to bring down that Bashar al-Assad's regime. But the upshot of all this is that we have populations of people in the Middle East, those who are Iranians, those who are Syrians, those who are from Middle Eastern nations that are sympathetic to the Iranians and the Syrians. Their perception is that we are waging a kind of low-grade war against their countries. And so when we have an open-door immigration policy and we allow each year hundreds of thousands of people to immigrate into Britain, largely without any kind of controls on who's allowed to come in or not, then we find that there are people who immigrate into Britain who regard Britain and the British people as their enemies. And it's quite sort of understandable that kind of situation would exist, and that people who have come to our country would feel the way that they do. And it should be of no surprise to British people that there are people immigrating into Britain who have a malign intention as far as our people are concerned, just simply because our government does everything that the American government instructs us to do, and our government is quite needlessly carrying out acts of aggression against Iran, and quite needlessly carrying out acts of aggression against Syria. You know, the Syrian government have never attacked Britain. The Iranians, apart from years and years ago when there was this Iranian embassy siege, but in that case it was Iranian dissidents attacking their own embassy that just happened to be in London. It wasn't an attack by Iranians against the British people. The Iranians haven't attacked us either. And yet we are forcing their country into an economic recession in order to prevent them from being able to develop nuclear weapons or nuclear technology. We assume that they're going to make nuclear weapons, but on the assumption that that they can't be trusted to have nuclear weapons. Well, if, and again, this goes back to the sort of arguments that we were talking about at the beginning of this program, if all people are created equal, then why are the Iranians regarded as being less trustworthy with nuclear weapons than Western governments? If all people are created equal and all people are just as likely to be bad or just as likely to be good as any person of any other nationality, any other religion or any other ethnicity, then why do we assume that these other countries, if they get hold of nuclear weapons, are going to start bombing everybody else, because we haven't been using nuclear weapons apart from the two nuclear weapons that were dropped on Japan at the end of the Second World War. Nobody has actually used nuclear weapons, and so that there shouldn't be an automatic assumption if all people are regarded as equal. But it seems to be that on the one hand, our government can decide quite arbitrarily that the government of another country can't be trusted and has a malign and an aggressive intent. And yet it's made illegal for people in this country to harbour any antipathy towards the people who have come from those countries whose governments are regarded as being untrustworthy and aggressors and where we need to apply restraints in order to stop them having the same kind of technology that we have. And again, there is an inconsistency here. You know, if we are supposed to accept that an Iranian doctor is just as good as a British doctor, why should we assume that the leaders of the Iranian government are any less trustworthy than the leaders of our own government?
And what's the top claimed destination for refugees that turn up in Britain now from the channel there, as we discussed earlier in the year? The main destination that they say that they have arrived from is Iran. So we welcome in these people claiming to be refugees from Iran, while at the same time engaging in economic warfare against their country of origin, and then make it illegal for us to say, well, that's a bit of a silly thing to do. They are likely to carry out attacks against us, as we see here with this man from Afghanistan, another country that we are actually engaged in war with our troops over there in Afghanistan, and we are supposed to just think that is just a random occurrence when that happens. And that hijacking of the tanker was completely illegal, because Iran and Syria are not a part of the EU. They're not signed up to EU sanctions. It's got nothing to do with Britain where this tanker goes or what this tanker does, because both Iran and Syria are nothing to do with the EU. So it was a total illegal hijacking. And as you said there, Max, about the mining of those tankers, and it was very strange. One of them was Japanese, and the Iranians actually had the Japanese ambassador in Tehran at the time when that tanker was mined. And I had been thinking, well, that's a bit of a false flag. But another possibility has been suggested by Dr. E. Michael Jones, and he said he's of the opinion that it could actually be Iran that are doing this, that mined those two ships, just to show that what they could do if America was to fire weapons at them, because that strait there is very, very important. And if they started mining ships, it would stop all the oil from getting around the world, and there would be serious problems. But if you can't have the oil there, then you've got no power. And basically, that is the ace in the deck that the Iranians hold, is that strip of coastline there. It belongs to them. They've got all their navy there and all the rest of it, and every one of those tankers that carries the oil to the rest of the world has to travel through that little strip. So that could have been them doing that.
The Iranian economy is dependent upon them selling their oil. They've been sort of limited under the sanctions imposed upon them to exporting 200,000 barrels a day, but they actually need to export 600,000 barrels a day in order to keep their economy afloat. So this is the same sort of situation that existed with Saddam Hussein and Iraq. You know, the argument was, oh, well, if Saddam Hussein has got control of the oil fields in Kuwait, he'll therefore hold the West to ransom. But the fact of the matter is that the Iraqis had to sell their oil to somebody. The Iraqis can't eat oil. They can't live in it. They can't wear it as clothing. They've got to sell it in order to gain the material benefits that they need in order to lead their lives. And in exactly the same way, the Iranians, they need to sell their oil. So, you know, they're not going to block the Straits of Hormuz and stop any oil from going through, because it would be counterproductive for them and it would bring about the collapse of their economy. So, you know, again, these arguments don't really work.
Well, it would be more like if they were attacked. That's what I mean. If missiles were fired at them, that is something that they could do, is then just attack those ships, because their economy is damaged anyway. It's like a, you know, like the we've got nuclear missiles pointed at everyone. If one lot of missiles goes off, another lot goes off, and you've got mutually assured destruction. If the Iranians were pushed too far, then they could say, right, well, sod it. We're just going to start blowing up these tankers because you've pushed it too far. You know, like the suicide option sort of thing. But I think the real upshot of all of this, and the conclusion that we can take from it, is we need to do two things. We need to send these people back to where they came from because they're a threat to us. And we need to stop interfering in other countries' affairs. What business have we got interfering in Iran's affairs, interfering in Syria's affairs? It's nothing to do with us. We've got our own problems that we need to be dealing with. And we can let the Iranians sort out their own problems, and we can let the Syrians sort out their own problems. I mean, Bashar al-Assad, as you say, he's there completely legitimately. They've had plenty of democratic votes, and he always wins by a landslide. We have no reason whatsoever to be going after them. The only reason we are is because Israel is pulling the strings of America, and America is pulling the strings of Britain. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Aryan Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
Aryan, for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.